and welcome to Worlds Apart. For the last couple of years, peace in Europe has seemed all but a lost cause, with all the links connecting Russia with the other continental nations being methodically severed over the conflict in Ukraine. But as the American appetite suddenly shifts to Greenland, does it leave an opening for a policy reversal? Well, to discuss that, I'm now joined by José Zarrilla, Spanish diplomat and author. Ambassador Zarrilla, it's a great honor to talk to you. Thank you very much for being here.
The honor is mine, Livo. Thank you very much for giving me the chance to express my thoughts. Believe me, in Spain, it's very difficult.
Well, let's use this opportunity, because I know that even before these latest developments over Greenland, you spoke about the need for the European Union or perhaps some individual European countries to rebuild their ties with Russia. And you argue that it makes strategic sense for Europe. Do you think European leaders may be a little bit more open or receptive to your argument now than, let's say, a month ago?
First of all, let me tell you that this is not a question that owes absolutely anything to false or truth. This is different. This is a political statement of loyalty towards the United States. When Merz said in Davos, we have to defend Denmark from Russia, it is obvious that this was not an exercise in cynicism or in ignorance. It was a political expression of loyalty towards the United States. Therefore, I would advise humbly to the Russian authorities not to say that they are not planning to invade Europe, because we all know Russia is not going to invade anything. It's simply a political question. So my perception of all this story is that we may have a chance of peace once this disaster of Ukraine comes to an end. When finally the hurly burly is done, when the battle is lost and won, when the families are allowed to grieve their fallen, and when memory begins to fade, perhaps it will be the moment to start thinking of what diplomats know only too well is the beginning, confidence-building measures. But for this, I think the dogs of war have to come back home. Right now, we are in the eye of the storm. As long as the weapons are talking in Ukraine, I don't see any hope.
Well, Ambassador, I think we are in the eye of two storms right now. And I think it's fair to say that at Davos, at least, the issue of Ukraine was of secondary or maybe even further importance. The central stage was occupied by Greenland. And let's focus on it for a moment, because I do think that this case may allow some European leaders to see the current geopolitical realities in a somewhat different light. And you mentioned this threat of Russian invasion that was invoked at Davos. And interestingly enough, this is the sort of argument that the Europeans have been extending for quite a number of years, that Russia is going to invade the Baltic states, Poland, what have you. But now Trump is using it to justify his own power grab on Greenland. Do you think Europeans are sympathetic to this line of argument by Trump that, you know, Greenland needs to be saved from the Russians by the Americans imposing their flag there?
I was very surprised to see that practically everybody in Europe stood behind Denmark. They were even willing to send troops to Greenland. It came as a surprise to me. But yes, I think this is one of the reasons why Trump backed down. So it was good news, you know. Finally, he gave up. And we have the hope of seeing the question enter into the realm of reason. Mm-hmm. Because, you know, Trump is convinced that if he grabs Greenland, this is equivalent to having an Arctic strategy. And this is not the case. Nobody knows, but you see, Alaska, no less than Alaska, which happens to be in the State of the Union, doesn't have a single decent port, you know, deep water port, and only has one icebreaker, whereas Russia has 40, and 7 of these happen to be nuclear power. Now, thinking that all this is going to be solved by grabbing Greenland, is childish.
Thank you for mentioning that Russia has a very extensive Arctic coastline, actually much more than we can develop at this moment, even though we do have the most formidable Arctic Sea Fleet at this point of time. But I think also, you know, Trump's using this Russia threat argument is not only farcical, it's also perhaps a way of beating the Europeans at their own game. Because, I mean, regardless of how many troops they send to Greenland, it's not going to protect Greenland from the Americans rather than from the Russians.
No, but this expression of firm commitment to Denmark has caused Trump lockdown. It's very important. Mm-hmm. He finally forgot about grabbing Greenland, which was a major cause of concern for anybody minimally interested in foreign affairs, because that would have created havoc, more than we already have, you know, more.
So do you think this case of Greenland is open and shut at this point of time? Do you think Trump forgot it forever, or he just backed down a step or two only to come back with, you know, greater force later on?
I think this is gone for good, as far as I can imagine, because, you know, Trump is, erratic. We don't know what is going to happen next, but in principle, it seems that, yes, he has realized that it's not a good idea. There were voices in the United States speaking of impeachment, you know. It's so incredible, so such an absurd idea that a NATO country could attack a NATO country, whereas, of course, the war in Ukraine is taking place because the only way to protect Ukraine is NATO. You can imagine, it's absolutely, it's an insanity, you know?
Let me run one theory by you. It sounds like a conspiracy theory, but I do think that it has some merit, because it was officially reported that during the meeting in Anchorage in Alaska last year, Trump and Putin did discuss the Arctic cooperation. And I think strategically, Russia wouldn't mind to have a wider American presence in the Arctic. In fact, if the two countries, or perhaps with the involvement of China, if they decide to develop the Northern Sea Route, that could create a major platform for great power cooperation and perhaps also a natural deterrent against, you know, great power competition. What do you think about it? Do you think actually like this idea of, you know, the Americans taking a larger foothold in Greenland may have been discussed between Putin and Trump?
Yes, why not? I mean, everybody is reasonable. China is reasonable. Russia is reasonable. The non-reasonable side are the United States. Nobody knows what they want. But you see, I think I would like to change a bit the order of factors. You know, the main enemy of the United States is not Russia. The main enemy of the United States is the absence of an enemy. If the United States do not have an enemy, they cannot spend billions in the military complex, which is what keeps the kettle boiling. Mm-hmm. You know, that's why Russia has to be an enemy.
Ambassador, I think it applies also to the European Union, because without Russia as an enemy, the EU is not really clear about its course of action, about how it's going to protect itself, about how it's going to develop itself, about what it stands for in the world. So to some extent, the need for the enemy on the European soil is even greater than on the American one, don't you think so?
Absolutely. Germany has already chosen, you know, they want to move from a welfare state to a militarized state. This is why, of course, the main enemy has to be Russia. This was prophesied by a legendary American diplomat, George F. Kennan. He said more or less, I don't remember the quote precisely, but he was something like, if the Soviet Union were to disappear in the waves of the ocean, we will have to find another enemy of similar import. Otherwise, that will be the end of the American industry. Unacceptable for the American industry.
And you know, what's interesting is that it seems that the new American administration has found a new enemy already, because Trump the other day essentially speculated that the greatest enemy is the enemy within, referring to NATO. And I do want to ask you about this, about the transatlantic relationship, because putting Greenland aside, the American policy for many decades has been quite thuggish and extractive vis-a-vis non-Western countries, and the EU has gone along with it. Not only that, it has fully put itself into dependency of the United States. Why do you think it did it to become so exclusively dependent on the United States? Did it perhaps think that it is somehow exempt from all the American exploitation?
Well, I think Carney is the Prime Minister of Canada. And he said it very well. Well, we comply, we humor the United States, because we thought that we would be spared from the treatment that the United States applies to others. But we have finally found out that we are going to be on the menu like any other, you know, like Vietnam was, Chile was, and Nicaragua was, you know, with the Contra. In the end, it serves nothing. So we were loyal, and in fact, what we were infamous. The line between loyalty and infamy is very, very thin, and we cross it. We in Europe cross it. But answering your question, there are two enemies for the United States. For the defense lobby, definitely Russia. And for the geopolitical mind at large, is China.
You mentioned the Canadian Prime Minister's speech at Davos, and everybody is celebrating him now. But what's lesser known is that before he delivered that speech, he actually went to China and signed a number of agreements there, including an agreement about strategic cooperation, about investment, about perhaps some areas of, some other areas of cooperation. Don't you think that this is perhaps a little bit too gutsy? Because if there were to be more Chinese presence in Canada, I don't think the United States would react all that friendly to that.
Well, you see, the United States cannot have the cake and eat it. So they will have to make a decision. This is 101 of international relations. If you cannot overpower your enemy, you find an ally. Remember Francis I in France in the days of the Renaissance. He was not able to overpower Charles V. He concluded an alliance with the Turks, you know, the Christian king. And this is 101 of international relations. This is basic. This is number, let's say, first course in international relations. What happens if you have an enemy of enormous, very important import, which is challenging you? What do you do? Find an ally.
I did take a couple of courses on international relations in America, by the way. But I think there is one thing is the theory of foreign policy, and another one is practice. And I think the major sort of precept of American mentality is that rules don't apply to them, and nobody else can have a cake and eat it too, except for them. So do you think that the exception still holds, though?
You have shown an outstanding perception. Asymmetry is the basis of all the American foreign policy. They can do what the rest of us cannot do. You know? And well, as a diplomat, I can tell you a personal story. So there was a meeting between a German delegation and an American delegation. So the American said, you are doing this, 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 and this with your cars. You cannot do it. So Germans are very serious people, reliable. They withdrew. And after some weeks, came back and said, we have been studying the situation. And well, this is what you, the United States, does. And the answer was, we were not discussing what we are doing. What we are discussing here is what you have to do.
Well, that's a very poignant story. And fortunately or unfortunately for the Europeans, that's still the state of affairs of the transatlantic relationship. Now, Ambassador, let's take a very short break at this point of time, but we will come back to this fascinating conversation in a few moments. Stay tuned.
This is it, Moscow. And you know why I'm here? Because when somebody tells me that I cannot report something, it's my nature as a journalist to question why. Why can you tell Ukraine's side of the story, but you can't tell Russia's side of the story? That would be a half-truth. You know another way of saying half-truth? A lie. When Washington or London or whoever tells me I'm not allowed to tell the truth, you know what I do? The opposite. I shine a light on it. That is the Sanchez Effect. And I'm Rick Sanchez. Look for it.
Это тайская тюрьма, это такая темно-оранжевая роба, шорты, кандалы на ногах. Тайский судья на одном из слушаний: скажите, у вас есть факты, как он собирался убить американцев? Он говорит: нет. Тогда вы придумали всю эту историю? Да. Тайский судья сказал: да вы что, мы все-таки не ваша колония, да что вы нам приказывали? Нужно же вначале создать миф, потом его хорошо продать. Они из меня сделали самого страшного человека в мире. Когда тебя ведут, тебя держат три человека, как бешеную собаку. Я шучу, говорю: хорошо, спасибо, что ошейник с палкой не надели, да? И ты улыбаешься, ты смеешься, а это их заводит больше всего.
Welcome back to Worlds Apart with José Zarrilla, a Spanish diplomat and author. Ambassador Zarrilla, let me ask you one more question about enemies, in this case, the enemies of the European Union, because over the last couple of years, nationalism has been a bit of a swear word in Europe. Europe has tried to suppress national interest with very great vigor, but right now it has to deal with its predecessor, imperialism practiced by none other than the United States. Ideologically, what do you think is a bigger problem for Europe at this point of time?
Well, I will answer you with a mathematical question. Mathematical. Europe, in Europe, adding is not possible. I will explain it quickly. Six German soldiers plus four French soldiers do not make 10 European soldiers.
Why is that?
Because the Germans are Germans and the French are French. The sum of the two doesn't make a European fighting body. That is the key question. Try to convince an Spaniard that Russia is an enemy. That's impossible. Try to convince a Pole that Russia is a threat. Impossible. So nationalism in the end rules on the continent. And the result is, we are 450 million people. We have an impressive commercial turnover. But since we are not united, we do not have a common parliament, we do not have a common power, we are bound to do as we are told.
Well, I mean, if nationalism rules, then maybe it's a shadow government, because at this point of time, as you said, foreign policy is relegated to the European Union, which it's not exactly clear whose interests the European Union represents. So when you talk, for example, about the need for Europe to reconsider its ties with Russia, who do you think can lead the way? Do you envisage it in the form of the EU leadership, some individual European nations, or, I don't know, some other power? How do you see it?
Well, this is the question of the mother of all questions. This is the mother of all questions. But I am convinced that once the war in Ukraine is over, things will start to become normal again. Right now, we are in a moment of, maximum hostility, Russia is winning. And that brings, the European countries to despair, because they invested so much in this, both political and capital, that to see it come to an end and implode is like a terrible tragedy. It's the end of times. So let's hope that finally some form of agreement is reached. And from that moment, very likely, say Italy and France, which are the closer to Russia, will give a step forward. Spain too, I hope. we will give a step forward and we'll go back to the normal days, which should be dictated. We should know it. You know, Bismarck said it. The union of Germany and Russia is good for us and for Europe. And whenever we broke this knot, it was bad for our two countries and for Europe. And he was absolutely right. And that continues to be the essence of the question. But only the United States, of course, insists on bleeding and weakening Russia, which is not in the interest of Europe. Simple, simple, simple.
Well, I do agree with you 100%, but to some extent, it's not about Russia. It's not even about the United States. It's about how the European Union sees itself. I mean, its purpose, how it conducts its policy, whose interests it represents. And like, there are more questions than answers on this front. Now, there is a slight hope in me that after, you know, this little debacle with Greenland, that, you know, some powers, political powers in Europe would come to their senses and understand that at the very least they need a smidgen of strategic autonomy and access to good energy sources in order to develop, in order to have some security in case their big daddy in Washington walks away or decides to attack them. Do you see any chance for a policy reversal on that front? How the Europeans, meaning the European Union at this point, conceptualizes itself?
Well, quite frankly, with the people at the helm right now, impossible. Think of Caja Caras. Caras is not received, neither in Washington nor in Moscow. Caras didn't know that China had been belligerent in the Second World War. Caras had the daring to say, it would be a good idea if Russia loses, because then we can split it into two or three different countries. Now, this is what we have at the helm of diplomacy in the European Union. With these people, how on earth can we expect any minimum, a modicum of a strategy? It's absurd, impossible. These people have to go.
Now, we discussed a number of European countries. I do want to ask you a specific question about the role of Great Britain, which I think perhaps has done more than any other nation to stoke the Ukrainian fire. Where do you see London going after all of this? Do you think it's going to be sticking with the EU policy, or is it more likely to side with the Americans?
Obviously, the war comes to an end and peace again comes back to this tormented land of Ukraine, very likely England will have to assume that it has no longer the support of the United States. So if the United States decide to stop, you know, they will stop. Don't forget it. Though it is true that, you know, it's very historical. That should be the object of a different meeting. Always, 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 England was against Russia. This is a very old story. Since the day Russia finally overpowered Sweden and Poland, immediately England saw the danger of a big power moving to the center of Europe. And that was, up for them, that was a tragedy. They tried to prevent it at all costs. They tried in Crimea, and then with the civil war after the takeover, the communist takeover, and again, you know, with in the 50s, with terrorism and in the Soviet Union. And finally, after the demise of the Soviet Union, again at the forefront of hostility against Russia, you know, it's disheartening. A country with such an incredible political clout, I don't know why they insist on a losing ground. It's a losing party. It doesn't make any sense.
Well, one theory here in Moscow is that it makes them feel irrelevant. I mean, they sabotage and act as a spoiler, but, you know, that keeps them involved rather than, you know, conducting any meaningful and productive policy vis-a-vis Russia or vis-a-vis any of the, you know, other nations.
You are absolutely right again. you both. I suspected that heavily. I didn't want to say it, you know, but that's the truth. That's the only way they have to, you know, to say, we are here, you know, we exist. We are weakening Russia. We are helping you to weaken Russia. It is not true that we are no longer a big empire. You know, we are something. We are the weakeners of Russia. Pathetic. It's pathetic, you know. But that's the way it is.
Now, Ambassador, and I do want to add some optimism to our conversation. And in one of your articles, you did write that nothing, no animosity is everlasting, that the Russian Empire was able to rebuild its ties with France after the Napoleonic invasion, that the Soviet Union created a strong economic partnership with Germany after World War II. What makes you believe that some resurrection of ties is possible right now, given the state of mind of the European leadership, which we have already discussed?
Well, you know, right now the situation is that we are in the midst of a civil war. The West is in the midst of a civil war. It's Russia against the rest of the West. It's Lorca against Anna Akhmatova. It's Don Quixote against the War and Peace. This has to come to an end. Someone has to see it as I see it, you know. Let's put an end to this absurd hostility and let's find again the unity of the West. Let's fight for the unity of the West. We are the same, Zapad, as you say in Russian, you know. We are all the West.
Well, I don't agree that we are all the West, but I could agree that we are all Europe, that we are all part of Europe and that we do all have a stake in the security of this continent.
Not only that, I think that the same spirit that created War and Peace, Lev Tolstoy, is the one that created Don Quixote.
Let me ask you one last question. Even if this conflict comes to an end, Ukraine is still going to be a big rotting wound in the middle of Europe with its economy destroyed, with its population traumatized and dispersed, with its political leadership delegitimized. And to some extent, it's a common security challenge. I mean, it's a major security challenge for Russia, but I think it's also a major security challenge for the European Union. Do you see any chance for any constructive, productive cooperation between the two, between Russia and the EU, in order to rebuild Ukraine, in order to put it back on its feet?
It's inevitable. This is what we have to do. That could be probably one of the common causes for both Russia and the European Union, no? The reconstruction of Ukraine, even if we disagree on the final cause, because for some of us, that's a clear American blunder, you know, it's an unbelievable mistake. And total, finally, a total snafu. I don't know if you are familiar with the term snafu. Snafu is a military American acronym, and it means snafu is situation normal. Excuse me, all up. Yes.
Well, that's not exactly Leo Tolstoy's language, though, right?
Well, yes, I would like to. You asked me before something, and I would like speaking about the sense of destiny of the United States. I'm going to quote a German philosopher, which spoke after the First World War, and he said, "The Anglo-Saxon spirit does nothing without moral grounding. The habit stems from the old Puritan spirit, which serves to provide it with a good conscience for the sake of profit and the excesses of power." I hope this answers your question.
Well, Ambassador, there is a lot to think about, but for the time being, thank you very much for being on the show.
Thanks to you, Leo. Thank you. Thank you for a lovely interview. Thank you.
And thank you for watching. See you next week on Worlds Apart.